We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the program a talented writer, author of a couple of terrific books, A Futile and Stupid Gesture, Orson Welles' last movie, and you've seen his work in places like Esquire, Salon, Atlantic Monthly, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune. I could go on and on. Josh Karp joins us this afternoon. Josh, welcome back.
Hey, Rich, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I meant to ask you this the first time you were on because you wrote about your unique training methods. How's your golf game?
Not that. I was just on vacation and played a couple times, and I'm doing all right. I care less about how I play, so I play a little bit better, not caring so much. Kind of trying to enjoy what I'm doing rather than thinking I'm about to go out and win the Masters.
But consistently straight down the middle, right?
Oh, always.
I wanted to talk with you a lot more this time around about Orson Welles. We touched on him the first time you were on with us, and he's one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. But I wonder, do you think there's a danger? For years, Citizen Kane was always, in whatever list came out, it was always at the top of the list as the greatest film of all time. And recent years, sometimes it's there, sometimes it's The Godfather, and there are other possibilities. Is there a danger of people maybe forgetting Kane, or at least forgetting the incredible innovations that were a part of that film?
Oh, absolutely. When I was working on the book, I was teaching journalism at Northwestern, and I was, doing some research one day and before class, and one of my students came in and they said, what are you doing? And I said, oh, I'm, doing some research on this book and what's it about? And I said, oh, it's about Orson Welles. And we ran through, I was like, Citizen Kane, no. Everything, you would identify Orson Welles by until we got to the pee commercial where he goes totally crazy, during the radio and yells at the guy who's telling him what to do. So, really, if you're under, I would say maybe 40, he's really like he's the pee guy or he's the drunk guy on the Parmesan commercials. But so, there is a danger. That a movie like that and a talent like his gets forgotten over the course of time.
I worry too, and I hear this a lot from young people, well, mostly my students. If I show something in black and white in class, I get that immediate eye roll from some kids. Ah, it's black and white. Well, I want to watch this. And I try to explain to them, but it often falls on deaf ears.
Yeah. I think, it's funny. I love black and white films, and I have four kids, and I've kind of tried to get them to watch them. And, sometimes it really works, but it's got to be like the Marx Brothers or It's a Wonderful Life or something like that. But otherwise, they just completely tune out. And I think that and it's such a terrible problem because there's so many great, great films made before color that are better, than so many color films. I saw Casablanca in an actual movie theater about a year ago, and it's just unbelievable when you see a movie like that shown the way it was meant to be shown.
If we assume that Citizen Kane is Welles' greatest film, what to you would be number two on that list?
Well, my favorite film of his other than that is The Lady from Shanghai. Mm. It's such a weird movie. Somebody said it was the weirdest great movie or the greatest weird movie ever made. And it's just such a fun movie to watch. And I enjoy his performance in it, and it's so unbelievably interesting. Everybody talks about it, but the mirror scene at the end is an amazing scene, and kind of watching that over and over when I was working on the book and trying to discern how Welles was able to do it was, that was really fun. He was a guy who just absolutely always had to kind of up his degree of difficulty on everything he did. And that to me, it was really interesting. It was like making a movie wasn't enough of a challenge for him. He had to do something nobody else had ever done every time, he came to bat.
One of my favorites, and it's amazing to me how many people have never seen it. I have probably seen it a dozen times. I absolutely love F for Fake.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a great, and that's a very, innovative
innovative film. And it was, you know, it was a film he actually, I don't know if you know, but he took it over kind of midway through from another director and turned it into something completely different than what it had been intended to be. But it was great because it was, you know, this movie all about, you know, a forger and what's real and what's not. And it was very much in keeping with Wells' persona and where he was going, you know, with his films at the time.
Of the acting gigs that he took where he wasn't the director, what are a couple that stand out for you along the way? And there were so many great ones.
Yeah, you know, probably the one that everybody says, but I'll say it, is The Third Man. He's just amazing in that. He's, you know, everything. One thing about him is he was just somebody who was such a presence, even before he became the gigantic Orson Welles, even when he was a young man. He's just somebody who, when he walks on screen in any film, it becomes, you know, you can't take your eyes off of him. He's just this kind of, you know, he's not, you know, the world's, you know, best looking guy, not the world's most charismatic guy or whatever, but he has huge, you know, energy. So in The Third Man, you know, he just really, it's one of the roles he actually kind of underplays a little bit. Instead of being like Orson Welles, you know, he's just kind of an act, you know, he's being an actor in it. So that's the one I like most.
And I don't think it's great acting necessarily, but another film where I can't take my eyes off him when he's on screen is Catch 22.
Oh, sure. And, you know, he apparently when he was making that film, Mike Nichols was just absolutely terrified to have him on the set. I mean, he, like, you know, that when they cast him, he was like, are you kidding me? Did I have to direct Orson Welles? And I think there are a couple of good stories about him, you know, not wanting to come out of his trailer to direct Orson when Orson arrived on the set, because, you know, not only was he, you know, this larger than life filmmaker, he was such a presence, and he was the kind of person who, you know, depending on his mood, tell you exactly how everything ought to be done.
We're talking with Josh Karp here on Downtown, the author of Orson Welles' last movie, the great documentary They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, chronicling the making, the journey, the epic journey of completing The Other Side of the Wind. The character of Jake Hannaford is very interesting. As you explain in the book, it's hard to pin down who he is, certainly an amalgam of a lot of people that Welles encountered along the way, and maybe a glance in the mirror as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's John Ford, he's John Huston, he's, you know, all the kind of manly directors when directors were figures. You know, you don't think of, you know, you don't hear anything about Steven Soderbergh's fascinating life, you know, away from making films. But with those guys, I mean, you know, their persona off screen was as big as the kind of the films they made, you know, and they were these heart drinking, hell raising, you know, geniuses. And so, you know, I always thought that Welles kind of used that persona, and actually casting Huston in the role did it perfectly, as kind of a way of telling his own story without it looking autobiographical. You know, at one point he and Huston sat down, and just the idea of the two of them being together was actually, when I was thinking about writing a book, I was like, oh God, when am I ever going to get to write about two guys like that? You know, I mean, really, I mean, you know, you're talking, people aren't like that. They don't make people like that anymore. You know, it's a whole kind of just everything about them is so outsized. But they were sitting there, and, you know, Huston said to him, wow, what's this, what the hell is this film about anyway? And Orson said something like, you know, it's about a bastard director who destroys everybody's lives. And then he paused, you know, did a big Orson pause, and he said, it's about us, John. You know, so I think, you know, he always denied that it was his, you know, that it was autobiographical, but I think he had a great way of pretending it wasn't, because he cast John Huston, whose persona was so opposite of Orson's. You know, Orson was not, you know, even though he was a big cigar-smoking, you know, hard-drinking guy, he wasn't, you know, somebody who was, you know, seemed like his whole life was trying to kill himself, like, you know, like Huston's was. But yet always living despite the odds. He was a little bit less adventuresome as a human being off screen.
One of the most famous characters in the story of the making of The Other Side of the Wind is Gary Graver, who essentially talked himself into a job that really became a lifetime job.
Yeah. You know, that, that, to me, before I started the book, was one of the most fascinating things. I mean, you know, at the time Wells started making the film in 1970, you know, there was this huge kind of, like, Roger Corman's movies, these, you know, horror movies and these biker movies and these exploitation movies. That was like a film school. If people would go to work for Corman and they would learn how to make a movie. And Corman would pay them nothing, but he'd let them have total control over making the picture. And that's where a lot of people got their training, including Peter Bogdanovich. I think Ron Howard made films for him. And Gary was a cinematographer in that world. And he really just worshipped Orson Welles. And so the story, and this was kind of just too good to even have in a book, was that he was with his wife at Schwab's drugstore one afternoon. He picked up Variety, and he looked, and there was an Army Archer little, you know, one of those ... columns about who's seen here and there, that Orson Welles in town planning to make his film The Other Side of the Wind. And he goes, where would Orson Welles be staying if he was here? And he calls the Beverly, he calls a couple places, and they call the Beverly Hills Hotel. And he says, Orson Welles, please. And the call goes through. And all of a sudden, you know, he doesn't just have Orson Welles on the other end of the line. He has, like, Orson Welles, you know, he's got the voice and everything. And he says, you know, who is this? And he says, my name's Gary Graver. I'm a cameraman. I'd love to work with you. And Orson kind of blows him off and says, you know, God, give me your phone number. Maybe I'll call you sometime. Click. And so Gary's like, oh, I've blown my big shot. And he and his wife go home, and they're pulling into their driveway in Laurel Canyon, and he hears the phone ringing inside, and he just instinctively knows, and he runs to the house, and he picks it up, and he goes, Gary, it's Orson. He says, you've got to get down to the Beverly Hills Hotel right away. And he gets in his car, and he speeds away, and that really is the rest of his life. He spends working for Orson, trying to get The Other Side of the Wind made, and, shooting porn films on the side to make a living. But I can't think of another relationship like theirs, because he gave his life to Orson Welles, and he gave his life to The Other Side of the Wind.
And then even got Welles to help out with one of his pornographic films.
Yeah, that was that was really funny. I found myself having possibly the weirdest conversation of my entire career with Joe McBride, who's a great writer, who was very helpful to me, and he had written several books about Welles. And there's a porn movie called 3 AM starring a woman named Georgina Spelvin, and who I guess was a big porn star in the mid-70s. And the story was that Gary, always said yes to Orson, and always, you know, if Orson needed him, he'd run. And he lost a couple marriages because of that, and he was always, you know, working 24 hours a day for Orson and then trying to earn a living on the side. And so finally, this one time, he stood his ground. And he said, Orson, I cannot come back to work until I finish editing this film 3 a.m. And Orson says, okay, what can I do to help you? And so he goes over to Gary's house, and they're editing the film. And Orson says, you know, he's trying to cut together different scenes. And he goes, well, I'll cut together that scene. And it is a scene in a shower involving two women. And Joe McBride had reported it as being a certain one kind of pornographic act, and I realized that it was a lesbian, you know, scene. And he and I are on the phone discussing whether this is a lesbian scene or a solo scene. It was like this is really the weirdest thing I'm ever going to do in my life. But yeah, so Orson Welles, if you watch 3 a.m., there is a scene that Welles edited, and he did it in like real Welles fashion, which I always love. It kind of has all these like Wellesian flourishes in the editing and strange angles and all that. And I always, you know, think it's so great that when asked to do something just to get it done, he couldn't do it anyway, but in the Orson Welles manner.
I love it. We're going to be talking with Peter Bogdanovich next week. And of course, he and Welles had a complicated relationship, and that kind of made its way to the screen and Other Side of the Wind, with Bogdanovich playing one character and then Rich Little, at least for a while, sort of playing Bogdanovich.
Yeah. I mean, that to me, whenever I have to sum up the story of that film in, you know, a paragraph, I always say, you know, Welles started shooting it in 1970, and at the time Bogdanovich was a young director, but he was basically a journalist, and he was writing a book about Welles. And he, in the film, in 1970, plays a guy who's writing a book about the main character, and a the film journalist. And the character is a lot like Peter. Peter loves to do celebrity impressions. The guy did impressions, you know, and all of this stuff. And so then Bogdanovich goes off and makes like three hit films in a row. He makes The Last Picture Show. He makes, what's it called, Paper Moon. And he makes What's Up, Doc? And there is a character that Welles adds at one point that is a protege of the main character who likes to do impressions and who has made three hit films in a row and is the hottest young director in Hollywood, which is exactly what Peter was at the time. And inexplicably, I mean, I guess because the character likes to do impressions, he hires Rich Little, which I just always love that idea. And Rich Little, I think, was completely baffled by the entire experience of making a film. Though I will say, interviewing him, I got to hear, I didn't tape the interview, but he did conversations between Welles and Houston in their voices.
Oh, God. Wow.
And it was like, I regret not having taped that because it was fantastic. But what happened was he, for various reasons, wound up leaving the film after 3 months without his part shot. And so Welles calls up Bogdanovich. He says, oh, I'm in terrible trouble. What am I going to do? You know, Rich Little left. We haven't finished his scene. And now I got to start the movie all over again. What am I going to do? And Peter says, why don't I play the part? And Orson goes, oh, my God, would you? Because I never even thought of that. And he says, you know, Orson, he says, you know, it's a young filmmaker who's made three hit films in a row and likes to do impressions. He said, you never thought of me for the role? He said, well, thank God. Oh, my God, you're going to come here. So Bogdanovich goes, you know, and Welles says, we'll reshoot your other scenes with somebody else playing that part. And so basically Bogdanovich goes from playing who he is in 1970, in the film in 1970, and in 1974 plays who he has become. And that to me just always, that is the essence of what that film was about, just the way Welles blended life and art, and then, it was kind of art imitating life, and then at some point it became life imitating art. And he and Bogdanovich had a falling out that actually happened in the film a year before he and Bogdanovich had the actual falling out, which to me was just the most surreal thing. Mm.
Josh Karp, the author of Orson Welles' last movie. Josh, as always, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for visiting with us this afternoon. We'll have to do it again
anytime.
Before too long.
I would love it. Thank you so much, Rich.
Thank you. Josh Karp on Downtown.